In a time of fear, loss, and outrage, Americans needed one thing above all else.
Terrorism against our nation will not stand.
Leadership.
Get me home. The American people want to know where their dang president is.
Based on real-life accounts.
America is under attack.
Showtime Entertainment presents an original docudrama.
Whoever did this isn't going to like me as president.
That takes you inside the White House on that tragic September day.
Sorry, Mr. Vice President, we've got three threats on the White House.
We're at war.
This president isn't about to sling a few missiles at a tent and not follow through.
The hijackers were trained at Al-Qaeda camps in Afghanistan.
We have CIA paramilitary teams in country.
Either hand over Osama bin Laden or suffer the consequences.
Make sure what happened yesterday never happens to the American people ever again.
Mr. Speaker, the President of the United States.
Timothy Bottoms stars.
The entire world has seen for itself the state of our union, and it is strong.
In DC 9/11 Time of Crisis, coming to video and DVD in September.
Was often unwatchable, like just as like a like take all the rest away from it, like just as a
it just dragged on yeah. and on yeah. and
like
on
like
and
it's
on.
Like I the first time I looked at the clock on it, it was like the end of September 11th, right? And I looked at the timer and I was like, oh my god, there's still an hour and a half of this thing left. Like mm-hmm. I was like, how? That said, like, it is a relatively, like, straightforward recapitulation of, like, the Bush administration's policy in response to 9/11. Like, I think that's the unexpected thing about this movie, is that it's actually mostly focused on the ways in which policy was set in the week after 9/11.
Yeah, I mean, you literally heard, I put that in our notes, but like we literally heard, you know, the line from Bush saying to the Attorney General, like, you do whatever you want to do or do what you need to do to make sure this never happens again using unconventional means. And then within 45 days, we get the Patriot Act. So,
well, and I think that one of the things that we'll, you know, underline in this is the way, you know, the film DC 9/11 Time of Crisis is mostly geared towards explaining and creating public understanding for the Wolfowitz doctrine, right?
Yeah.
The doctrine of Donald Rumsfeld's advisor, Paul Wolfowitz, who as soon as the film like shifts away from sort of the day of 9/11 being its like main focus, they mm-hmm. start to sort of, even before Paul Wolfowitz has been on screen, they kind of sort of start to build this, you know, you're with us or you're against us kind of, you know, rhetoric, right? And then as soon as I started to hear it, I was like, oh, here comes the Wolfowitz doctrine stuff. And as soon as it went through my head, boom, Paul Wolfowitz is on screen sitting on his couch. And I was like, oh my God, well, here we go. But I actually have some stuff I want to say about like the cast and the writing and the directing of this movie.
Oh, you mean like how George fucking Takei is in this?
I mean, he is in sort of like a throwaway role. Yeah. He's in this thing. And like you see him
which is so weird to me because he's like a really significant actor historically.
Well, and I think it's
as a major following. I mean, this is before social media, but I mean,
exactly.
Like now he has a major following on social media as like this, you know, liberal bastion.
Well, I'm not all that interested in Takei. His role here isn't that significant, and I think it's pretty easy to spot him.
He doesn't do much. So
well, and I think also that like you know the idea that somebody who's 10 years away from you know building some social media following for middle of the road, you know, liberal opinions or something would be the type of person who in 2002 was in a propaganda piece about 9/11 and the Bush administration.
Yeah.
But let's talk about the people who actually wrote this thing, mm-hmm. right? So because as you watch it, right, you're assuming that it was like literally written by like Henry Kissinger's like grandson or something. But if you go and you look at the credits for DC 9/11 Time of Crisis, what you find is that both the writer and the director of this were born in the UK. Brian Trenchard Smith and Lionel Chetwynd, right? I mean, where else could they be from? But these two guys are both from Britain, basically. I mean, just to sort of lay this out, you know, Austin and I had been saying to each other as we were watching this that it like verged on satire, right? Like there were certain moments where, and I think especially having watched Verhoeven as our first review for this podcast, I think that we were sort of primed to watch it from that perspective. And so Brian Trenchard Smith is the director for this thing. Mm-hmm. And he's actually known for making like small budget, like satirical films. And if you go back and you like look at his credits and stuff, you know, he's got a lot of those types of things, right? Like sort of making a large scale movie on a small budget, but a lot of them,
but like you're so I mean like there's all I'm like looking at his Wikipedia page too, and he's also done biblical films and he wrote the screenplay and produced the Genie nominated Kissinger and Nixon in 1995. Mm-hmm. And also did a Tom Clancy's like ABC miniseries. So that also can tell you exactly what you need to know about like the material that this guy does.
Right. So. But Trenchard Smith is, I think, sort of less the mastermind here than his writer, who is a ghoul, who's somebody who could literally have, like, if you just look at him, he could literally have just been one of the guys in the cabinet meeting. So Lionel Chetwynd is another Brit, right? Who grew up in Canada, right? And who, let me just sort of read his background for you, like before he even gets into film and screenwriting and stuff. So here you go. This is Lionel Chetwynd. He's the writer credited for the film DC 9/11 Time of Crisis. Upon completion of military service, which he did enlisting at the age of 14 in Canada. Jesus. Upon completion of that military service, he gained conditional admittance to Sir George Williams University, which is now Concordia, in Montreal, where he did a bachelor's degree. Graduated valedictorian after just 3 years and received a scholarship to McGill, right? Just the...
Good, yeah, ever have McGill.
If you ever have any dorky friends from Canada, that's probably... ask them if they've been. But he received his law degree. During that period, he was a champion debater, right? And ended up going to Oxford, right? On to complete his graduate studies. Okay, so then this is sort of where you start to wonder, like this is the sort of career of a propagandist, right? Is you have this background, and then you have this jump. To Chetwynd, then joined the London office of Columbia Pictures, where he remained for 4 years, and by then had begun to expand to like freelance writing and production. Okay, and then so as you're reading through this, it's like relatively standard stuff until you get to the 80s, right? And Chetwynd is this supporter of the Reagan administration, and here's what you get: he does the Hanoi Hilton to Heal a Nation, he does Kissinger and Nixon. Right. Yep. As well as an Emmy nominated Ike Countdown to D-Day. Right. And so I think that Chetwynd and the director of this, Brian Trenchard Smith, worked together on Kissinger and Nixon. Right. And so this duo had had a had a working relationship, right? But you can see how as soon as the 80s hit, something happens in the career of Lionel Chetwynd, right? Where he basically becomes like a propagandist for the American right, okay? And so that's like, that's the duo here, is you have these two like right-wing Brits who end up doing propaganda in the 80s and the 90s, and then culminating when in 2001, Lionel Chetwynd, the writer of DC 9/11 Time of Crisis, was appointed to the President's Committee on the Arts and Humanities, right? And so this is the position that he's occupying in 2001, right? Ostensibly ahead of the attacks on 9/11. So he is quite literally the chief propagandist of the Bush administration in 2001. And that is, I think, the best way to sort of frame DC 9/11 Time of Crisis and our discussion of it.
My the other bit that I just like enjoyed about this film was how hard they tried to portray Bush as like in command of like what was going on, when that was not the anyone with any any set of critical thinking skills knows that Cheney was was the puppeteer when this was going on. Like,
and in fact, most of the actual sort of like massaging of the facts here, the rest of it's a relatively straightforward like capitulation, just sort of boiled down a little bit. But the one like PR project of this film, you're absolutely right, is to rehabilitate the centrality of George W. Bush
to the planning
of the post 9/11 landscape.
They went about it was so cheesy, Yeah. And it made me cringe in several parts. Like,
And we'll get into it, but I want to cover two things before we do. I want to talk about Timothy Bottoms, right, who is cast to play George W. Bush. And I want to talk about the project for a new American century. Right. And once we've done that, I think that we are ready to discuss this film. So first, Timothy Bottoms, who is cast to play George W. Bush.
Mm-hmm.
And I think there's this really interesting thing that has happened, which is that so Timothy Bottoms, by the time 9/11 happens, has already played George W. Bush twice. And he's played him in Trey Parker satire, which was produced in a 3-month run before 9/11. So from like April to like the middle of the summer, Timothy Bottoms had played a like satirical George W. Bush on the like satirical sitcom of the South Park creators. He had also appeared as George W. Bush in a Crocodile Hunter movie. All of this before he's cast as George W. Bush in a non-satirical role, ostensibly non-satirical role, in DC 9/11 Time of Crisis.
Oh my God, that's so funny.
By the end of the Bush administration, literally every talented person on television had a W impression that had been refined and perfected over years.
Yeah.
And so you watch Timothy Bottoms and you're like, oh, this is shit. He doesn't even sound like him. He barely even looks like him to me.
Mm-hmm.
And I think it's funny that this Timothy Bottoms was unanimously accepted as like a person who should portray George W. Bush, as a person who looked and sounded like him. But as somebody who's living, you know, on the other side, you know, downstream of the Bush administration, you just can't even believe him. Like he doesn't even come across as an authentic George W. Bush, because all you have in the back of your head is like John Stewart's impression or something, which comes across as much more like authentic somehow. But I think this is just important to keep in mind that it's like we have this movie was produced by somebody who had been practicing portraying George W. Bush for over a year, and two people who were chief propagandists of the American right. And what is capitulated in this is what I think can essentially be read as a campaign trail re-election piece,
and
a movie that support and it's also a movie that is selling the Iraq War, right?
Yeah.
This is coming out in the months leading up to the Iraq War in 2003, leading up to the invasion, right? And it is constantly trying to both sell the Iraq War and downplay the extent to which it was originally the intention of the people in George W. Bush's cabinet to cast 9/11 as a cause for this broader project in the Middle East, right?
Mm-hmm.
And so, and that brings me to the project for a new American century. So this is one of these things that Project for New American Century is one of these things that like tinfoil hat wearing conspiracy theorists just lose their minds over because here you go, right? So in 1997, right, the Project for the New American Century was formed. And I'm going to tell you what it did, but first I need to tell you who was in it. The original signers of the chartering white paper of PNAC included Elliot Abrams and Jeb Bush and Dick Cheney, but also Scooter Libby, Vice President Dan Quayle, and then critically Donald Rumsfeld and Paul Wolfowitz. Right, there's other members as well who ended up occupying significant positions in the Bush administration. Among them, John Bolton, Gene Kirkpatrick, Charles Krauthammer, as well as, folks in the CIA, et cetera, right? So PNAC, right, the Project for a New American Century, laid out their program in a series of reports, letters, and statements. They demanded increased defense spending, completion of the U.S. domination of space, and deployment of a sweeping missile defense system. They insisted that the United States be able to fight and decisively win multiple simultaneous major theater wars and police critical regions, especially the oil-rich Middle East. Their first order of business was toppling Saddam Hussein and establishing a new government under the aegis of Ahmed Shalabi and his Iraqi National Congress. In January 1988, PNAC urged Clinton, then President Bill Clinton, to circumvent the UN Security Council and take unilateral military action, but Saddam hadn't provided sufficient provocation yet. By the way, I'm reading here from Peter Kuznick's The Untold History of the United States, which has one of the most comprehensive accounting of the extent to which the Bush administration was already invested in this conflict. So you have all of these people who are on the Project for the New American Century who agree that the objective of U.S. foreign policy should be expanded in the Middle East, right? Should mm-hmm. be used for, all they needed, and they say it in their white papers, all they needed was the sufficient justification to pursue that policy. Yeah. And lo and behold, on the day of 9/11, which is where our film opens, Donald Rumsfeld is in a room with a bunch of people from the Project for New American Century, including himself, right, discussing a lack of funding for precisely these imperial goals. And that's where the film opens. It is 6 a.m. on 9/11, and Donald Rumsfeld is in a room with congressmen and national security advisors talking about how Social Security is a wonderful thing, but without national security, it'll be no use, congressman, Rumsfeld says, within 2 minutes of the start of the film, which I think is an awfully honest telling for what is ultimately a propaganda piece, right? To begin there, right? And I think that it's worth remembering the Project for the New American Century, right? It's worth knowing where the writers and the directors came from here. And it's worth knowing that Timothy Bottoms had been preparing for this role for over a year by the time he's casting.
Something I've realized as we're talking about this is we just spent basically 20 minutes laying the groundwork for why this film, this just obscure docudrama on Showtime, why it exists. So that alone right there should say enough about what this film was made for, and given the timing of it before the election. And so I don't know, that is significant to me. So.
And I think you have to be willing to put yourself in the headspace of like your like conservative first grade teacher or something, and just like remember that like these people were lionized. The Donald Rumsfeld, George W. Bush, Dick Cheney.
Oh, speaking of people who were lionized, I mean, there's also a moment in the film where Bush or whoever goes, you know, call Rudy and see how he's doing, basically. You know?
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
Who was America's mayor?
Which is interesting because it's like well, and it's interesting because it's almost like at that level, it's almost like giving. There was an attempt to sort of try to build a national politician out of Rudy Giuliani, and he does get like basically just a cameo out of this. But you forget how legitimately Rudy Giuliani ran for president at one point, you know, at the end of the Bush administration, and that he was actually supposed to be legit, you know, not the cartoon he is now, but an actual cartoon. You know, Republican. An actual cartoon instead of just a caricature. So we open with this scene where Rumsfeld is like literally discussing the imperial objectives of the American state in the first scene of this movie. And I found that really striking. And I think it might go to like it would almost be satire if we weren't so certain.
I mean, as I noted when we were talking about this film last night, like one of my favorite, like, just brief scenes in this movie is right after the plane or the crash happened at the Pentagon. There's just these images of Rumsfeld's, you know, actor wheeling, helping wheel people out of the wreckage with IV bags.
So apparently he did. Like he was helping at the crash site on September 11th.
Oh my God. There's an image of it. Oh yeah. My God.
Yeah. Yeah. So Rumsfeld, and I think that that's like a good backdrop, is that like these guys were the ideal heroes of like 50, 60, 70 year old people, conservatives and sort of center of the road Democrats.
Oh, yeah.
These were people who were seen as heroes. I think it's easy to forget now, but there was just sort of a class of elderly people. They're all almost dead now, but who, like, Donald Rumsfeld was like the perfect embodiment of what they thought and felt about the United States. And he is kind of at the center of this film. But I think that like all of us who have now like seen the movie Vice or something, have the tools to sort of watch this movie in a very critical way and note how so much of what is portrayed in Vice, the 2018 film with Christian Bale as Dick Cheney, right? Mm-hmm. That a lot of what the argument that's made in that movie can still be found here. But let's get into it. So after we see Rumsfeld, you know, lamenting the lack of funding for national security in the first scene of this movie, we cut to George W. Bush reading to the school children, right? And at that moment, a man walks up to him and just like in an almost sexual way, whispers in his ear,
"America is under attack."
And there's even like some like lingering on like the vowels of the word attack in a way that is just almost like it's like you're expecting like the hair on the back of W's neck to like raise up and for him to get like a semi from it or something. But sure enough, he does. Right. And so you have him like getting out of the, you know, this room with all the school children that we remember him in. And so back at the White House, and this is the moment from this movie that I remember so clearly, is Condoleezza Rice coming into the room where like Dick Cheney and you know, these other members of the, you know, of the cabinet who are at the White House. Condi comes into the room and says, just immediately, "Al-Qaeda? Question mark?" Right? Like, which is something that wasn't actually known, right? Like, it's literally like that is the sort of propaganda element of this film, is that there's like this immediate understanding that, okay, this was Al-Qaeda, like on the morning of, right?
Yeah.
And that's, I mean, that's, oh, there was is a much, fabrication.
In reality, there was much deliberation in the public. Right. the public eye of you know,
and in fact, later on in the movie, we get some of this deliberation and this uncertainty about who's responsible and everything. But in sort of the most memorable 40 minutes, the 40 minutes that you're like willing that people like wanted to watch, because I think you're a real like there's something wrong with you if you saw the last hour and a half of this movie. But in the 40 minutes that everybody was guaranteed to watch, you have this just immediate association made between Condoleezza Rice and Dick Cheney that this is Al Qaeda. The first 40 minutes is just like is like, you know, tragedy porn and W on Air Force One going,
the American people want to know where their dang president is.
Right. And it's like and I think that's the proof of sort of, you know, this bifurcation between the head of state and the chief executive that went on between Bush and Cheney. Right. Is that most of Bush's day is spent like worrying about public perception of his administration on the day of this attack, right? Like he's up in the air in Air Force One complaining that the media and the people need to see him and all this sort of stuff. Meanwhile, on the ground, right, you have the person really directing the national security infrastructure, which is Dick Cheney. And Dick Cheney is working to keep W on the plane, to keep him out of DC, right, so that he can occupy this role as the unitary executive. And I think this is the most memorable scene from Vice, I think, is where you realize that on 9/11, Dick Cheney was running the federal government, right? Yeah. That he's in the decision room, you know, making all the calls, and he would mainly stay there for the remainder of the Bush administration. And so, you know, I mean, literally, this movie has W looking outside the window at one point, looking at the F-16s, going, I guess we're at war. and that's what it was. I mean, that's a striking view into what was going on this day. And it's like, just
even as hard as they tried to portray Bush as like in command, you know, there were still elements of like Cheney's reign kind of like leaking out here and Bush's kind of bumblingness also, you know, on display and stuff like that. And I love that.
No matter how like ready it seems like these folks should be. I mean, they've literally been writing white papers about how good of a day 9/11 would be for the broader foreign policy goals of the American state. And yet all these people are in position to like take advantage of it. But on the day, pants completely down. Like, and I think that's like sort of the thing is you have all these people who mm-hmm. you know, with their unitary executive theory and their realist imperialism, et cetera, et cetera. And yet at the end of the day, like, it's just guys, you know, in a room, mostly performing like a PR function who all of a sudden have to snap into like once in a generation readiness in a morning, you know, to be able to sort of like take advantage of their situation.
Crazy to like read like what was going on during these moments and see that like Cheney had, there was no like, he didn't vocalize any concern about American citizens on, you know, the airliners themselves. Just you know, it's almost like he intentionally forgot they were American, you know, that these planes were just solely being operated by, you know, hijackers, and there weren't any American citizens on them at all. And that's how he was, you know, how he viewed it, which is
because he's the real killer, right? I mean, I said, I can't stress enough that if before you see this movie, if you're going to subject yourself to this, you have to see Vice, because it'll just give you like the cheat sheet for sort of reading all of this stuff that's admittedly being shown on the screen, but is being like, you know, is being explained to you sort of through the lens of George W. Bush as the actual, you know, as the consul, right, as the dictator on the day, right? And he's absolutely not, because we have Cheney trying to keep him on the plane as long as he can so that he can stay in the big chair, at least officially, right? So we have Cheney in the PIOC, like, you know, directing the state, and we have W trapped on the plane bitching about how the American people need to see their dang president. And that's where he was when Dick Cheney was running the country. So so that's most of what happens on the day before W makes it back to DC, right? And immediately as soon as he gets back to DC, we snap into discussing the Wolfowitz doctrine, right? And we're going to sort of see all of this like sort of begin to sort of gradually snap into place, you know, almost as soon as the tragedy porn is over, we get in down to the brass tacks of you know, the Bush doctrine, of the Wolfowitz doctrine. And it's funny because it's like, you know, I think everybody remembers that address that W gave from the Oval Office. And it's funny because, like, I don't think people remember it as being bad, right? Like, you know, if anything, you know, it was like the last time we sort of saw the pre-Wolfowitz doctrine, George W. Bush, right? The sort of relatively moderate Republican who now, if like you play his stuff from the 2000 campaign trail about like immigration and entitlements and all this sort of stuff, you can't believe it's a Republican talking, right? And I think this is sort of the last night that we see that George W. Bush. And what we have is, as he's like going to the Oval Office to like give this speech, right, to give this address, he's telling all the speech writers to pull the call for war out of this evening address, right? And you get Paul Wolfowitz like sitting on the couch, like breaking pencils as he's giving, you know, this pussy ass like address to the nation and everything. and it's like, and so, you know, so it's like from that day forward, right? So there's like, you know, the speechwriters and the non-PNAC people didn't have enough time to put their PR spin into effect on the day, right? And so you end up with this sort of flaccid, address from the Oval Office that night, which I don't think anybody remembers as being bad, right? Like no one in the public, but among the NatSec types and among like Karl Rove and the people, you know, running comms for the Bush administration, this was like the bad speech. Right. That they have to shift away from in the week after 9/11. Right. And so we start to get into the unconventional ways to make sure this never happens again. Right. That becomes the focus of the show. And I think it's interesting to sort of talk about how the domestic side of things is just like brushed aside, right? Because the remainder of this movie after the day of 9/11 is like just basically a series of like cabinet meetings and meetings with the staff and the NatSec team and all this sort of stuff, right? Joint Chiefs and using that context to just sort of communicate the policy of the Bush administration after 9/11. Mm-hmm. And in these meetings, there's always like the front half of it where we talk to the attorney general who's talking about, you know, all of the stuff that they're doing to like the Patriot Act and all this stuff to sort of like, you know, target Muslims living in the United States and everything that went with the Homeland Security apparatus that the Bush administration installed. And it's brushed aside.
Not only that, not only that, but this is, people tend to forget that like the events that take place in this movie, are the foundation for what like Edward Snowden revealed, you know, in 2013 or whenever that was. Like the mass surveillance of American citizens that is revealed, you know, being perpetrated by the NSA, like that is a result of 9/11 and those events and everything that transpired, you know, within 60 days after that. So
we get down to the end of the day, and I think we have sort of this Throughout this movie, in sort of an effort to sort of show W as like a sort of like a virile, capable, you know, executive and leader. We get lots of scenes of him like lifting weights and stuff. Like they're sort of like, you know, at the start of each day,
getting ready for war.
At the start of each day, it's like he's like shown like pumping iron, right? Like, which I think would be like way too, like, I don't think you could get away with that now. Like, you couldn't just be like, oh, he's a capable man.
What other way can he prepare to kill a bunch of Iraqi civilians? That's how you're supposed to do it, Michael.
He needed to be doing some wrist workout so he could sign all the death warrants. But so,
right.
And I think that this is like driven home because it's like the one, we don't see W on the morning of 9/11, right? But when he finally makes it to his own bed, right, at the end of the day of September 11th, and he and Laura have this scene together. We're told that he ran 3 miles at the start of the day, and that's why he's exhausted going to bed before 11. I feel like that's the, like, do you think, because that's the thing that we're told, is that like at 11:50, they are like rushed out of their bedroom to try to like get them underground and stuff. And so we know that George W. Bush went to bed exhausted on 9/11 before 11 p.m. Do you think Dick Cheney slept on the night of 9/11? You think Dick Cheney was probably...
Exactly. Yeah. Even more evidence. Like, even more evidence of the reality of what was going on.
Before midnight on 9/11. The president of the United States exhausted because he started the morning at 6 a.m. with a 3 mile run. And I think that we've got, you know, in the next morning we get more of W pumping iron, like while he's on the phone with Tony Blair, like, and they cast like a beautiful British man to play Tony Blair, when in reality he looks like everybody else on that fucking island. But you have this beautiful actor playing like Tony Blair. And W, like, you know, on the phone, like, you know, lifting, curling a weight in one hand and telling Tony Blair, I want to inflict pain, you know, and Tony Blair shifts uncomfortably around his now fully erect penis. And they have this moment at the end of the call where you're expecting Tony Blair to be like, no, you hang up.
Right. Yeah.
So it's September 11th, or so it's now it's September 12th, right? And at this point, there's still an hour and 20 minutes left in this fucker. Like, it just went on and on and on. And so at this point, we get into sort of the earnestness of like the efforts to portray W as being the one in charge here. Right. We have this scene where he tells Dick Cheney that he wants to run the war cabinet. Right. Despite the fact that like not even FDR did that and everything. But of course, we know that, you know, that these are mostly symbolic things, because it's at about this point that Dick Cheney's presence on screen becomes almost entirely shot from his bunker, from like the vice president's, because you remember Dick Cheney, he had this like secret office, right? That people only found out about like after the Bush administration was like mostly over, like after the Iraq War had become unpopular. And I think that's one of the most honest things about this movie, is that W like tells Dick Cheney that like, we can't be in the same place ever again. We can't be decapitated. And so I'm going to stay here in the Oval Office. You go get down in the bunker and run the war. Right. And this is like presented as though it's like W like taking control, right? Staying in the Oval Office and doing all this stuff in front of the press, when in reality, we understand that staying in the Oval Office is not where the decisions are being made.
Yes. It's just, he's stepping into the public relations role. And Cheney is doing the mastermind things from the basement, you know? Yeah.
And this is presented in the movie as Cheney being, you know, sidelined to like W's, you know, like zeitgeist man of history, like role. When in reality, we understand that every time Cheney gets sent to the PIOC you know, to avoid decapitation, he's actually going to the nervous center of the American state yeah. and directing it. And aside from that, he's shown mostly on screen, like, you know, just sneering from a Zoom call or something
right.
for most of the remainder of the movie. And it's really chilling. And between that and this next scene with Rumsfeld at the Pentagon, there you could almost see some satire in this.
Oh yeah,
there is almost satire, because you cut to this scene at the Pentagon that's literally like lit like Dr. Strangelove, and it's somehow a much much scarier room than the well lit one that we began the movie in just 24 hours before. And there's all this discussion now about which seemed legitimate in 2002, but it's very funny now, about like keeping a small footprint in the Middle East and avoiding the Soviet mistakes and making sure that this doesn't turn into another Vietnam. Right. And all this stuff that, you know, you're reminded that all of the fears of what existed of an anti-war movement in the United States at the time, all of their fears became real. Like literally every single thing about how this is going to be a shit show and a quagmire and everything that they're like consciously like explaining away in this film, and as the Bush administration did in real life, turns out to be true. all of the same Soviet mistakes. It was worse than Vietnam, right? And it's in terms of its length and futility, right? And the footprint wasn't small. And it did destabilize all of these other places. And basically everything the Bush administration said it wouldn't do and is saying it wouldn't do in this movie ends up happening.
Yeah. Yeah.
One of my favorite things about this, right, is that we have like all of the like national security stuff and the stuff with the War Cabinet and the Joint Chiefs and all of this. But in the other room, we go to the West Wing, right? We go to like the Aaron Sorkin part of this movie, and we have like Karl Rove and the comm staff, you know, discussing basically the premise of this entire film, right? There's literally a scene between mm-hmm. Karl Rove and one of the people on the comm staff where they're like reading the op-eds from September 12th. When people pointed out that it's like, everyone knew on the day that Cheney had been in charge the whole time while W had been, you know, either out of pocket or definitely up in the air or at Offutt in Nebraska and all this sort of stuff. And so the op-eds captured this on September 12th. And you literally have Karl Rove and the comm staff, you know, being like, oh, well, it's going to be hard to beat the myth that Dick Cheney is actually in charge and that the POTUS is, you know, incapable and incompetent and everything. And it's like, that was the pitch for the film. I imagine that in that exact room, Karl Rove and the writer and the director of DC 9/11 Time of Crisis, that they literally had this exact discussion when pitching the film. Right. And I think it's weird. It's a really interesting artistic choice to show the film being pitched on the screen. Like, because there's this like acknowledgement that's what's, you know, that's what's going on here. And I think we would be remiss to discuss September 12th without acknowledging what I think is quite faithfully portrayed on the screen, actually, which is that on that day, the Donald Rumsfeld and the people who were in the project for the New American Century began planning the Iraq War, and we've got a quote. I have a quote from Donald Rumsfeld that's going to nail it, right? So,
oh, wonderful.
Is again from Kuznick's Untold History, right? He says Donald Rumsfeld had already ordered the military to draw up strike plans for Iraq on September 12th. Go massive, he said. Sweep it all up. Things related and not. And this is being like relayed to us through counterterrorism chief Richard Clark, right? That's where the quotation from Rumsfeld comes from. So the counterterrorism chief,
yeah.
Here's Rumsfeld say, you know, go massive, sweep it all up, things related and not. Clark, the counterterrorism chief, assumed that Rumsfeld was joking when he said Iraq had better targets than Afghanistan. But he wasn't. On the morning of September 12th, CIA Director George Tenet ran into Richard Perle, and he was already trotting out the same line at the direction of Rumsfeld. Iraq has to pay a price for what happened yesterday. They bear responsibility. And so there was this sort of, you know, broad construction of terrorism and this desire to include Saddam Hussein and Iraq in it, because it legitimized the efforts to invade Afghanistan against these sort of like loose organizations of you know, terror cells that were being like given cover by the local, you know, warlords and the Taliban and like all these names and these groups that would become familiar to us over the next two decades, right? The word Taliban only appears like once in this entire film, just because at the time people didn't even understand the like politics or the local issues on the ground. But that's what we get, is we get this acknowledgement that Iraq had to be included to legitimize the effort to go into Afghanistan, right? Because the targets were better. There's this meeting with the congressional leadership where we have, you know, the leaders of the House for both parties, you know, they're just kowtowing to W on the day, right? But the gist of this meeting, right, is that we're fighting a frame of mind, right? There's this self-consciousness about how there isn't a clear enemy to declare war against. That's the reason that they want to sweep Iraq up into this, right? Is because there's like a platform, like a legal platform then for waging this war, whereas the legal platform for fighting an idea, right, is much less firm. But what ends up happening across, you know, September 12th is they articulate the Wolfowitz doctrine, right? And in order to sort of explain why they don't seek congressional approval, and I thought this was very interesting, is that they cite specificity, right? That it would be that seeking a declaration of war from Congress would be bad because it would have to become too specific, right? That it would constrain the imperial objectives in the region. And it's at this point that in order to sort of like reassure the congressmen that this is what we want to do, or why they should want to do it, is they say that, okay, well, this will not be Vietnam, right? Which I just like, it said, like the ghost of Vietnam is evoked so much in this movie that it's like they spoke it into existence, you know, like it's you know, you said Vietnam three times in the White House, and so its ghost reappeared over your bed at night. He's explaining to the congressman how this is like a new type of war. He's telling Condoleezza Rice that freedom is good. We're brushing aside the attorney general who's creating a framework for curtailing individual autonomy in the United States and persecuting Muslims, right? And it's at this point that Rumsfeld and Colin Powell begin to spar the argument about Saddam Hussein and Iraq, right? In sort of this context, Rumsfeld saying that, you know, when you define terrorism in its broadest sense, right, it includes Saddam Hussein, right? And Cheney backs up Rumsfeld by saying that including Iraq would, as we already pointed out, legitimize the effort to intervene in Afghanistan against al-Qaeda, right? I think it's worth reminding everyone at this point that Saddam Hussein and the insurgents in Afghanistan had all been our Cold War allies, right? That, you know, and I mean, by 2001, we're 10 years down the road from Saddam Hussein, who just sort of misinterpreted his mandate from the American state and invaded Kuwait. And then only to have, you know, the state for which he was a client turn on him for having, like I said, misinterpreted what he was told to do regarding oil shipping in the Gulf. Right. And so.
Right.
And so they're having this whole conversation about how this is, we're not going to make the mistakes of the Soviets. This isn't going to be Vietnam, but also all of our enemies were our allies 15 years ago. Right. And I think that, like that absurdity, right, is something that you didn't even have to acknowledge in 2002 when this movie's being made, and certainly not in 2003 when the war's being sold, because people, these were super abstract things, right? I mean, it blows my mind away now to like think about it, because I know that like how long 15 years actually is, right? And the idea that it had been 15 years, you know, give or take a couple, to get back to the Reagan administration in the mid 80s. And when Donald Rumsfeld is literally shaking Saddam Hussein's hand in Iraq, right? That people just didn't remember. Like, I mean, think about this. We're talking about events that were more recent to the people at the time than 9/11 is for us. And people just, these were obscure facts that Al-Qaeda and Saddam Hussein were our Cold War allies. This was something that, like, when you pointed out to people in the aftermath of 9/11, that they would be likely to not believe you, right? If you like explain to them, you know, sort of who these people are. You were a tin hat, you know, person with a conspiracy board in your cabinet, just for knowing this stuff at the time. Okay. So now it's September 13th. We have more weightlifting and somehow still over an hour left in this unwatchable movie, right? But I think that on the 13th, we start to really, we get a lot of screen time for our most evil cast members, right? There's this guy named Kofor Black, right? Who is, if you look him up, right, he's like an absolute ghoul. Like, but he's also, I think, the most well acted character in this entire movie. I couldn't find the actor who plays him, but Kofor Black is the, he ends up being the director of the Counterterrorism Center in the years after the September 11th attacks, right? He ends up appointed ambassador at large for the State Department, all this sort of stuff, right? The actor that portrays him in this movie probably gives the best performance of the entire film, as Kofor Black stands up in this Pentagon meeting with Bush and Cheney and tells him that about all of the things that the CIA is basically already doing to fuck up Afghanistan, right? Talking about all of the warlords we're going to jump in and fund, we're going to splinter, you know, basically the fabric of this society and put the entire, you know, enemy into retreat before US troops even land there. And he concludes right, with this line that is probably the best in the entire movie. The enemy will have flies on their eyeballs. And I think it, and it's very clear that they do a very good job of sort of showing how like W is just like completely manipulated by Kofor Black and you know, who's this scary dude. And there's like these like knowing nods from like Dick Cheney and stuff. It's like he had been like put up to this, right? Like that mm-hmm. the only obstacle to Dick Cheney and the PNAC people was just scaring W enough, right? And just making W believe that the people capable of doing hyper competent violence are in the room, you know, ready to act. Right. So we've got flies on the enemy is going to have flies on their eyeballs, says Kofor Black. Cut to 2 million people dead in the Middle East. You know, the vast majority of them civilians from conflicts in Iraq, Afghanistan, Syria, you know, all of the unraveling of the Middle East. Right. It should go back to, you know, this comment by Kofor Black about the flies on the eyeballs of women and children and civilians, mostly. We've got Karl Rove planning the PR, and Rove sets up, who's another one of the only sort of well acted, you know, characters in this, right? Is Karl Rove as W is there, like in the Oval Office, like taking phone calls in front of the press. Rove is there, like, sort of like practically mouthing the words as W is talking about how much he cares about, you know, all of these people and how sad it all makes him, et cetera, right? But Rove has planned for the end of the week this appearance at Ground Zero that is going to sort of like set the climax of this movie. Like, the climax of this movie is that on the Friday, W appeared at Ground Zero waving a flag and all this sort of stuff.
You get the motherfuckers, George.
Right.
You get them.
There's a scene at the end of the Thursday, right? So the end of the 13th, where Condoleezza Rice is shown at the Watergate, sitting down on her couch, right? Just watching TV and crying. And I think that, like, what's really fucked up, though, about this is that I think this is, like, one of the few scenes that might actually, like, get this movie to pass the Bechdel test. Right, because it's like the one scene in the entire movie that only has a woman on screen is Condoleezza Rice, a cold blooded killer in her own right, crying on the couch at the 9/11 coverage on her own, and it's like that's, I think that's the only scene in this entire movie that doesn't have a white man on the screen, and it's Condoleezza Rice crying on her couch, so. Now it's Friday, and Rumsfeld leads this like prayer before the cabinet meeting. And my favorite thing is like the portrayal of religion and Christianity in this, right? Because it's like, it's supposed to be a significant.
Well, think about who, you know, who made the movie. I mean, we literally at the beginning of this, we're talking about how the writer, like, basically, you know, helped create several biblical films. You know, that's.
Absolutely.
There it is,
but
right there.
I think that what's interesting, and I think this was true of the Bush administration and their portrayal of Christianity, and I think it's, I think it comes through in this as well, is that it's almost unrecognizable, right? Like from like actual tenets and doctrines of Christianity. Rumsfeld leads this prayer before the cabinet meeting. It's the first time the whole staff has been together since the attacks. And he prays, Lord, we pray now for thy guidance, that thy will be our will, and that we have the strength and patience to measure our lust for action. I don't want to get too much into, like, you know, what Christian doctrine is, right? But
yeah,
praying that the will of God is our will, and that, you know, that God just hold back our lust for strength and patience, right, is one of many moments in this movie where we have Christianity and faith kind of trotted out and yet are completely unrecognizable if you know anything about, like, you know, just like the doctrines of Christianity. For one thing, like, you don't pray to God to make that your will be God's will. Like, that's not the causal direction of these types of things. Like, that's like some Rome shit. Like, the Romans would be like, you know,
yeah,
that yeah, the God of war would, you know, imbue your lust for strength with their divine will.
But when you're selling this to the American public and trying to get people, you know, to go to war with you, literally, like, you know, what better way than convincing them that your actions following 9/11 are the will of God?
And I think that's really, I think there's a pertinent observation to be made about Christianity from that, which is that that's really, in the context of the United States, that's really what Christianity is it's a vehicle for justifying how you're already acting and planning to act, right? And all the rest of its meaning can just be essentially dropped because the prayer is only that, thy will be our will.
Yeah. How can I give myself some cover before I go commit some war crimes?
You know? We've got George Takei gets his longest speaking part in this. We have some creepy Karl Rove in a speechwriter's room. And then we get this scene at the National Cathedral, right? Which I think sort of fits into this like weird portrayal of Christianity that we get, where it's literally just W at the pulpit. And like this happened, right? And this happens at the National Cathedral a lot. It's not technically like a Christian space often it is kind of this interfaith kind of a gathering when they go to the National Cathedral. But we have Timothy Bottoms doing a bad job of being W, right? The problem is he's like he plays W really straight, right? When he needs more cowboy. Everything
he needs Texas.
Everything
he needs
about
more Texas.
This performance yeah. cries out for just a bit more twang, you know, just a bit more swagger. Mm. And these all these things that we now understand are essential to the W form, but which in 2002 had not quite been memed into comedic existence yet. But anyway, so we get this scene at Ground Zero, and Austin, would you just like describe what people are saying to him at Ground Zero?
Well, I think it's, you know, the first sort of thing that I like loved about it was just the sudden shift in like dramatic tone as he's like climbing up the rubble at Ground Zero and stuff like that. Like that's like the first really good part about it. And then you know, he's like, you know, he gets approached, or he goes up to like a worker, you know, that's like covered, and his face is like covered in like ash and soot and stuff like that. And you know, and then the guy basically tells him, you know, go kill them, George. Go kill them all. Yep. Go get those fuckers, basically. And you know that there's the moment in which George W. Bush gets permission from the American public in his head to go kill a bunch of Iraqis.
Well,
you know, that's
admittedly
that's where it happens.
And this honestly became a lot of what was done sort of after W had become unpopular, after the war had become unpopular, was to go back to this. Which is portrayed so clearly in this film from 2003, right? Which is that Americans were literally baying for blood at the site of Ground Zero, right? Which I suspect they were. I suspect that a lot of the shouts and the screams that you hear from the crowd, you know, that we literally have a character say, you know, like, kill the motherfuckers, George, you kill them. This is a Showtime TV movie, right? Where the word motherfucker is used. Like, I mean, and it's used in this way that like the censors were just like, no, go for it. you know, this is the moment, right? Yeah. Where you can say that in our TV. Admittedly, this is Showtime, but TV movie. And yeah, and I think that what we're getting here is sort of twofold, right? Which is the acknowledgement that, yeah, Americans were legitimately baying for the blood of women and children and civilians. In the aftermath of 9/11, but also that we're being shown, you know, by the propagandists that no matter how awful and bloody this war gets, you asked for it, right? Yeah. That the victims of 9/11 asked for it, that the first responders asked for it, right? And that whatever follows thereafter, whatever the unitary executive does, it was the will of the American people, because when George W. Bush went to Ground Zero, this is what you all asked for. And that's the function that ultimately, that's the thing, is like you're expecting his scene at Ground Zero, which is the climax of this movie, to be like sort of about like unity and rebuilding and all this sort of stuff. And he gets there, and it's literally the entire thing is just the entire point of the scene is to show normal people begging for blood and violence in response to it.
Yeah.
The terrorist attacks of 9/11, and that's the function of this scene, you know, and nothing more and nothing less. The climax of this film is to say that whatever comes next was personally requested by the survivors of 9/11. Okay, so now it's Saturday, and holy cow, there's still 40 minutes left in this movie, and I'm serious. That was the climax. The climax of this film is that scene at Ground Zero, and there is still 40 minutes.
Oh yeah. Yeah.
This fucker left. So, start out with George W. He's not lifting weights now, but he is on a run at like Camp David. And he's like talking like Marcus Aurelius about this nuanced war that we're going to have and everything. And I want to take a moment to acknowledge that like the scene at Camp David provides a nice sort of like relief, like visually in the film. But we should point out that Bro is on vacation again, right? Like that Camp David is like a, is like a vacation retreat for the president. And
yeah,
you know, highly security can still do his job there. But all of this is like underlining the fact that the, since taking office back in January of 2001, George W. Bush had spent more time on vacation than any other president, right? And keep in mind, this is with intelligence sitting on his desk that Osama bin Laden plans to attack the United States using airplanes, right? Like the intel had been collected by the Clinton administration, was on the president's desk, and Bro spent more time since election on vacation than any president had before. And here we have him at the end of the week on vacation again at Camp David. Let's see, all of these things being mostly glossed over. But anyway, so...
But people aren't paying attention to those details. So
I mean, the half a million anti-war liberals that that existed in this country were aware of these facts. But that was, once again, just like less than a million people in the streets as anti-war protesters in response to all of this. But anyway, there's this really interesting moment, though, at Camp David where Rumsfeld and Powell are again sort of like sparring this like debate, you know, over the size of the coalition, whether or not the, you know, if we include all these European allies, are they going to cut and run, you know, when things get tough and everything. And Rumsfeld has this moment where he points out that this isn't going to be like what happened with the Soviet Union, because what happened to the Soviet Union happened because we were arming all of these people in Afghanistan, right? Like there's just this straight up acknowledgement that all of these people were fighting in Afghanistan, you know, were only a problem for the Soviets because we were arming them. And of course, that line isn't really flowed through it anywhere else. But ultimately, regardless of this sort of like Marcus Aurelius nuance of war that W is sort of like portrayed as having here at Camp David, the decision is ultimately to go with the flies on the eyeballs. Briefly mention a domestic crackdown, and we sort of introduce the lie about the connection between bin Laden and Hussein, to which Powell says that we can't just use 9/11 as a license to hunt down anyone we want, right? Which has the air of like comedy, right? Like watching it from 20 years later.
There's the satire right there.
Is that you're right. The satire in this movie is in that line. It's in every time that they insist that this isn't going to be Iraq or that this that this isn't going to be Vietnam, right? And that we're not going to make the same mistakes that the Soviets made in Afghanistan, right? The satire is only legible two decades on, and I think that's how we know this is straight propaganda. So we're back in DC for the Sunday. We've got the communications team meeting again, and W does this thing where he starts flowing this conflict into the Cold War, right? That we can't give up what we fought for in the Cold War by shrinking away from the terms of the peace, right? At this point, it's literal hagiography. George W. Bush that was something that was written for him by speechwriters, right? That is, there's no way that George W. Bush is telling Condoleezza Rice that, like, of his own volition. That's something that the comm team wrote for him. And it's at that point that we're at literal hagiography. Because we have Cheney in his secret office, right, where he's attending meetings via Zoom at this point. And there is like at that point where we've literally like sort of gone into like a sort of like dystopian Strangelove like satire where he's like speaking from his secret office. You know, but anyway, so the rest of the movie is, you know, interminable. Right. But we get to this point where towards the end of the movie, where Laura Bush and W get their like second scene together, right? And Laura, you know, curls up next to W and says, don't ever forget about how they treat women. That's a big part of this. And this is the scene directly following the shot of W at the mosque, right? Where he says, our war is not with Islam, mm-hmm. Which is a religion of peace, right? And then in the next scene, Laura tells Bush, don't forget how they treat women. That's a big part of this, right? Like, just out of nowhere, right? We have this assertion that they, how they treat women, which is just like Muslim, like, is a nod towards Islam broadly as an enemy. Mm-hmm. Immediately after this scene at the mosque where W is there declaring our war is not with Islam, a religion of peace, right? And I just thought the sort of juxtaposition between that, where it's like, you know, here's the PR line, but here's what, you know, what we were, you know, what we actually meant all along.
No, but they use her line as evidence of the crusade.
Yeah,
itself.
Yeah. It's so really striking. And it's very intentionally done directly after you have him speaking from this mosque, right? W has a meeting with the comms team where he says that this is a war that may not end on my watch. And that was another moment of satire that's only observable, you know, with 2 decades of removal. And we get to this point where there's like, the conclusion of this movie is on September 20th, W gives like a joint address to Congress, right? And at this point, the movie ticks to the 2-hour mark. And it's at that point that you remember there were probably commercials in this fucker, right? That like, mm-hmm. this was like a 3.5.
Well, see, there I wonder, if it was Showtime?
I wonder.
Yeah. It was Showtime,
and there may not have been, but you know that at some point this was run in like syndication on some TV network that did have commercials. And at that point it must have been 3 hours long or something. And I can't imagine sitting through this thing with any interruption at all. But anyway, so we jump to this joint address of Congress, right? And we have like Dick Cheney, like, you know, like watching it from the Death Star, basically, while you have most of this address, most of this September 20th address is just in the movie, word for word, with shots spliced together from like real life and Timothy Bottoms. And then he's making this like final articulation of the Wolfowitz doctrine. And there becomes this moment where Timothy Bottoms' performance becomes so bad. And this is what I was thinking is that as he's going through this, I'm like, oh my God, he's doing such a bad job. And at the moment that I had that thought, they cut to like the in real life George W. Bush giving this address, like just like a seamless, like, you know, one moment it's Timothy Bottoms and the next it's literally George W. Bush. And it's at that point that you're clear that like this has all been like a campaign stop, right? On the road to 2004.
Oh yeah,
and certainly an effort to be like, you know here is the justification for the Iraq War here that is being launched as this movie is coming out. And
yeah.
And that really does bring us down to the end of it. And I just want to apologize, you know, to you, Austin, for forcing you to see this.
It was, I think I was very entertained by like the first like 30 minutes of it. And then it just became like an absolute fucking chore to like sit and have to like, I think what really drove me nuts was the actor playing Bush. And as we've highlighted, you know, several times over this conversation, like, you know, it's just it would have been more kind of easy to watch had there been more Texas from his character.
It needs more Texas. So. But I think that, you know, for Timothy Bottoms, you know, this was somebody who had like chops for playing W. And yet by the end of the administration, so many people had practiced their W impersonation that it's just completely unbelievable, right, because you've right. seen Jon Stewart do it better. Mm-hmm. In fact, you've seen Will Ferrell do it better. You've seen, you know, in fact, they had, what was the, there was a whole like sort of like satirical biopic about W at one point that has a better portrayal as well. And it's just, yeah, I think that's a big part of it. But I think the other part of it is about that, like, last half of the movie is it's literally just like a rote articulation of the Wolfowitz doctrine and like its various justifications mm-hmm. and how it like came to be debated. And it's,
oh yeah,
it is at that level of like historical analysis that has yet to be made, but that I think will become more clear, right? Is that the, you know, that a lot of what the Bush administration does here is sort of found the United States anew, right? To fundamentally change the state,
yeah.
its relationship to the public and the world in a way that may down the road be acknowledged as, you know, a third founding, right? You know, the second being what Lincoln does to the country through the Civil War, and this being, you know, kind of another iteration of it. And I think that it has that quality in part because the director and the writer had written things like that, right? I mean, Timothy Bottoms yeah. at one point yeah. plays David, like the biblical King David at one point. And there is sort of very much kind of a new nation being sort of founded in this. And it has kind of all of the qualities.
Yeah, which is so weird. It's such a weird, just bizarre. It's just a really bizarre mm-hmm. thing to consider.
And that we may, that interpretation may only be accentuated mm-hmm. as we sort of see what the empire will become.
But I mean, it makes sense because we saw, I mean, the rapid transformation of the American surveillance state after 9/11. I mean, so yeah, I mean, like what was a new nation created after that? I think it's, you can say yes, but not in the way that the writers of this movie right. are trying to portray, you know. This is a much different sort of structure arose rather than the one that they're trying to make it seem like.
Well, yeah, and I think that this is maybe a good place to leave it, is that I think that what this movie manages to do in a lot of ways is relatively faithfully portray the events and the decisions, right? And yet
yeah.
complete and yet, you know, frame them all within sort of this light that is meant to sort of defend the capabilities and competence of George W. Bush, right? And to sort of dissuade the audience from thinking all of the things that, you know, would pull them away from this new founding, right? From this new doctrine of intervention and empire. And but the events on scene and the arguments being made on screen are basically as they were. Right. There's not like an effort to like obfuscate the arguments. Right. You know, on September 12th, you know, you literally have, as we know, you have Rumsfeld and these folks beginning to argue for the inclusion of Iraq and the broadening of the definition of terrorism and all this sort of stuff. And it's awful to watch. It's mostly unwatchable at certain points, but really, really striking as a work of propaganda, and I would just love to know who gave the nudge to make this movie happen.
This is an independently produced podcast. You can support us by subscribing and help us make more episodes by going to our Patreon page. We'll see you next week on COINTELPRO.